is that's not fair.
In other words, the presumption is that it will be 40%, which allows flexibility.
It's only fair if you get one that comes under the top of me.
Yeah, we should all just we should all just look.
So we said this is probably much
but that's smile.
I woke up at 5:15 and worked out.
Makes the morning
let
go
me
nice.
Read it. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've got
that little
calls break yes. stuff about
yes.
it.
Yes.
So, yeah. More in session.
The E-12 Education Committee will come to order, okay. And we are have quite a little bit to do, hoping that some more of the committee members will come soon. Today and tomorrow, we're going to spend that time in committee going over the governor's budget recommendations and try to understand some of the proposals that he has laid out for us, as well as some of the information on the spreadsheet. And sometimes I know it took a number of years actually to kind of understand what those spreadsheets, how they operate, and how to interpret them. So we're going to actually start out with that, and I'm sure there'll probably be some questions as other members come. But we'll have Mr. Nauman, who puts that information together for us, go over it. And if there's any questions, feel free to ask, and we'll see if we can get a kind of a good understanding of what this all means. So, Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, I'm working off of the legal size document in your packet that's got November forecast columns on the left-hand side of the document and then governor's rec beginning in about the center of the page. And the primary column that I'll be working off of is difference governor minus November 2010, 2011. And I'm going to do a fairly quick run through on this, trusting that the department will go into greater detail about the implications and the policy choices behind the numbers. We'll just lay out what the numbers are. And another note is that there will be a number of occasions where I just make reference to this is a shift change, because the governor's package includes two separate shifts, one of which passes through a whole variety of accounts. It's a larger policy choice that has implications on a number of appropriations. And I'll show you how to cheat sheet some of that as we go through. So the first reference is on line 8. The governor recommends an expansion of the QCOMP program that's about $41.4 million. There's a slight reduction in the extended time formula, saving about $10,000. Governor has a pay-for-performance plan that spends about $91 million in 10 and 11. The governor recommends the repeal of the contract penalty. This is the January 15th deadline that penalizes school districts that don't settle their contracts. The governor's plan also includes the conversion of the Perpich Center to a charter school. So there'll be a couple of lines here where dollars get added back as a result of that, pupil units that we make an assumption about going back to their home neighborhood school generates additional costs. So there's some offsetting directions. Then the first on line 14 is the first reference to the school payment shift. This is the payment schedule moving from a 90-10 schedule to an 80-20 schedule. In general education, that saves $571 million. Then there's also the property tax recognition shift, which I'm sure Dr. Melcher will go into great detail about, which is a little bit of a forecast. I'm sure he's going to want to do that. $605 million. And then as part of those shifts, we recreate the advanced final payment for school districts that are in SOD, and so that carries a bit of a cost, $6.3 million roughly. So in total in general education, there's about $1 billion in savings relative to the forecast. Now, members, as you look at the titles on the lines, occasionally you will see one that's underlined off to the left. Those are payment shift affected lines. So if there's a change in that, unless I make reference to it, it's just the shift change. So we can skip all the way down to line 40, where you see the additional cost from additional pupil units associated with the Perpich conversion to a charter school. There's a $250,000 cost. And you see that the line above it, charter school building lease aid, there's savings there, and that's just shift. And the same would apply on line 41. Perpetual effect on line 42 for charter school startup. On line 44, there's just shift associated with integration aid. On line 45, the governor recommends a policy choice of capping the integration revenue program at FY09 levels. Then skipping down to testing, there is an expansion of the testing appropriation by $7.5 million. And then a new program called Summer of Success on line 54, roughly $9.5 million dollars. Been looking at the federal law too much, Mr. Chairman. Math and Science Centers, line 68, $1.5 million a year for a total appropriation of $3 million. And then a series of grant programs, UTEACH, Minnesota Virtual Education, Principals Leadership Institute, which has been appropriated in the past, and the SMART program. So the Education Excellence grouping is up $5.6 million. In special education, we have the shift effect, which saves $86.9 million. And in the facilities and technology, again, everything that we're seeing here changed is a shift effect, saving almost $3 million. And that, I think, basically concludes the education aids portion. You can see that on line 127. Before we get into the early childhood accounts, the governor's recommendation is down about $1.1 billion. And members should note, if you, for comparative purposes, if you slide over to the right and you look at the governor's rec for 12 and 13, that once the one-time nature of these shifts gets washed out, that there's $73 million above the base in the governor's recommendation. So then moving quickly on to the...
Mr. Nolan, is the positive... In the out years, is that a reflection of the fact that the shift gets automatically purchased back?
Mr. Chairman, no. There is no that provision that you're referring to occurs only when the forecast goes positive, and unfortunately, we don't have a estimation that the forecast is going positive at this point. So there is no buyback. What we're seeing primarily here is some of the effects of. You know, there is a tail effect on some of the shifts. You can see that online, primarily on lines 14 and 15, where there continues to be some savings. But it is primarily a one-time shift. The big number occurs in 10, fiscal 10. I think the positive would be more of a reflection of some of the governor's initiatives on the statewide QComp expansion, for example. And the pay for performance plan, which are sort of the big items that are recommended in the governor's budget this year. So then, Mr. Chairman, moving on to the early childhood accounts, we see the shift effect in the early children and family support services, saving $3.7 million. Again, in the prevention area, we see some savings there, minor shift effects, and the same with self-sufficiency and lifelong learning. Moving down to the Department of Education, there's some rulemaking in the governor's recommendation for principal licensure standards, carrying a $125,000 cost, a College of Education Reforms cost of $85,000, and then the governor reduces the general operating budget for the agency by $410,000 a year, so there's $820,000 in savings. So the agency is down $610,000. On line 183, we see the savings associated with the conversion of the Perpich School to a charter school. In fiscal 10, there is no effect, and the real changes begin in 11, saving $4.3 million, and then that agency is effectively zeroed out in fiscal 12 and 13, so you can see those line items. And then, Mr. Chairman, the last item that I will, individual item that I'll mention, excuse me, is on line 190, a reduction of $238 a year for the Faribault Academies. And then on line 199, the total E-12 appropriations are down $1.138 million, and the tail is up $57,185. That is a number that includes the shift effects, both the recognition as well as the payment shift. So as we've done in the past, we show what the effect is without the shift so you can get a real sense of what the policy changes are. That would be line 212. So the governor's recommendation, when you net off the shifts, is an increase of $156.7 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Baja.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Nauman, the document that I'm looking at only goes to line 191.
Mr. Chairman and members, are you perhaps looking at the levy tracking, which is the subsequent pages?
Don't
I'm on
have
line.
A different.
I'm on page 5.
Mr. Chairman, that was not in my packet. Thank you.
Okay. This is page 5, and let's see. Okay, Mr. Nauman. Excuse me, Senator Rimmel.
I was just going to ask, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Nauman would restate that calculation at the end.
Sure.
Of what the shift meant and what we're.
Line 199 shows what we would actually appropriate in the bill if this were, if you were to pass the governor's bill and this were the tracking. This is what we would show in actual appropriations and the savings. It's the line 190, the 1.138.
Okay.
Is what the governor's bill saves, and the increase relative to the base and the tail is $57,185. But then we offset the shifts, and that's what's happening in the lines 202 through 210. So you can see a total shift effect of saving $1.3 billion. And then you net those two numbers off against each other, and it shows the governor's policy recommendations increase the K-12 budget by $156.7 million in 10 and 11, and $201.4 million in 12 and 13. And so, Mr.
Members, on item 212, line 212, the heading is total general fund excluding the shift.
I get it.
So it's it gives you the perspective that of the shift impact. Okay. Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think what Senator Bonhoff was looking at earlier was the E-12 tracking on the property taxes, which is the next document. But I think perhaps, I think maybe what's important is perhaps the bottom line. If you flip to the very last page, there are some of these initiatives that the governor has carry some levy effect. The Q comp and the integration carry some savings and others. But I think perhaps it's best just to get to the bill. So I'll just mention that on line 176, the total certified levies after the credits in fiscal year 2011 is up $8.6 million, and the tail for 12 and 13 are 19.9 and 17.9, respectively.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, unless there are questions, I think that quickly gets through the numbers.
Okay, we'll be coming back, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I haven't, and Mr. Nauman, I haven't looked over this carefully. Is that figure make any estimation of referendum levies, or are these only the levies that are a part of our statute authorized ones?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you may want to call your attention to line 20, which is the referendum. And you'll notice that it increases over time. The department, as part of the forecasting process, does make has a fairly intricate process of estimating future referenda. There's a sort of a growth factor that they build into the forecasting process. So to the extent that we would make a change in referendum, we would be adjusting off of that base.
So Mr. Chair and Mr. Nauman, can you do a quick calculation of what percentage of the referendum or the property tax increase projected out is attributable to the referendum?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the 8.6, the 19.9, and the 17.9 that I referenced earlier are net just the governor's changes. That's not referendum effect. So it's just the effect of the governor's policy.
Okay,
if you'd like, I can go through and do those growth factors, but I think that answers where you're going.
Okay. Next we have actual legislation, and I'd like to invite Deputy Commissioner Anderson and Dr. Melcher, and then they will can in turn, as you go through the legislation, anyone else that would like to come up and help. So, Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think what we'll do is go through the bill language, article and section by section, and we're providing the PowerPoint to members as informational in their packets, and they can take a look at it. We may refer to specific slides and talking about some of the governor's initiatives, but we'll start by going through the bill.
Deputy Commissioner, before we start, give your name and for the record, please.
Sure. For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner, and Dr. Melcher is going to start out with Article 1, Section 1.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 1, Section 1 of the Governor's Bill would change the method that is used to calculate the minimum length of the school year. The stricken language is the existing calculation, which requires a school district to have at least the number of days that they had adopted in their calendar in the 1996-97 school year. The governor is recommending that that be changed from a daily basis to an hourly basis. We do have some flexible school years out there. A district may be operating on a four-day week, and we think what's the most important is the amount of time, not the number of days. Also, the use of the 96-97 school year is problematic. It's getting quite old, and also we have a number of charter schools that didn't even exist in 1996-97, and so there's no way of calculating a minimum length of a school year for them. So this would be a change. The number of hours that are being recommended, the 425 hours, is equivalent to 2.5 hours a day for kindergarten for 170 days. The 935 hours for elementary schools is the equivalent of 5.5 hours a day for 170 days, and the 1,020 hours is the equivalent of 6 hours a day for 170 days. But the idea would be that districts have flexibility. If they have more days, they could have fewer hours per day. If they have fewer days, some are considering 4-day week, they would have more hours per day. But number of hours just makes more sense than the number of days to us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, while you're on the subject of school calendar, what is the authority of the department as it relates to waivers?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wieger, there is a provision in law that allows the department to grant a waiver for a flexible school year. And the department did grant a waiver to the McRae School District that's currently on a 4-day school week, and there are some other districts that are currently considering a 4-day school week. Currently, there's no penalty in law for not operating the minimum number of days, so we may have some school districts or charter schools that aren't complying with the existing requirement, but if they don't do that, there's no penalty. There is a provision in this bill that I'll get to a little later that would reinstitute the penalty that we had back in the before the mid-90s that would, in fact, require school districts to comply with these minimums, but that would have a waiver as well. If the district had some unusual circumstances, the commissioner could waive the penalty in the event that the district provided documentation as to why it couldn't be at the minimum.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Melcher, does the waiver provisions apply to the calendar?
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Melcher.
Senator Wieger, the existing waiver provision in terms of the flexible school year is to allow the school district to have a different calendar. It also applies if you're referring to the Labor Day start. There is a provision that allows a school district with a flexible school year calendar to start before Labor Day, and there's also a provision dealing with school districts that have major construction projects to request a waiver to begin school before Labor Day. But there isn't a general provision that simply allows the commissioner to waive the Labor Day start for any reason. It's tied to the construction issue or to the approval for a year-round calendar.
Thank you.
Members, before I go on, there is a summary in your packet, in case you wanted to follow along. Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Section 2 of Article 1 reflects the governor's proposal to move QCOMP to be mandatory rather than voluntary. So you'll see the may has been stricken. It's must now. And we've removed the school site because it's now mandatory. It's not voluntary. So at previously, individual school sites could enter into the program with, if there was an agreement between the board and the exclusive representative of the teachers. And now this program is moving to become mandatory. This does not mean there still remains negotiations at the local level. The plan is still locally negotiated and designed, and it's still subject to approval by the department. But this reflects the governor's proposal to move towards mandatory compliance with this area.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Anderson, why wouldn't the governor want to expand it for principals if it's good for all the teachers?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Wieger, that's certainly something the department has been considering. We have talked to our stakeholders, our existing participants in the program. They felt that while they would like to have principals in the program, that the funding right now is dedicated to teachers, and they were concerned about moving funding from teachers to principals. And so we're continuing that discussion with the principal organizations and with our stakeholders. But locally, there's nothing in this law that prevents a school district from negotiating with principals, and some have. We have several programs, approved programs, that have negotiated performance pay and some other provisions with their principals based on the revisions of this program.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hand first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Anderson, I wanted just to clarify on this provision that of the mandatory nature of the QCOMP. And I've had some discussions with school districts and with others about how this is to work. And if the requirement is that in order for a QCOMP plan to come into effect, it has to be negotiated between bargaining units and administrations, unless we do something to override that bargaining process, how can this be mandatory? In that, I mean, we can certainly put language saying that you have to enter into a negotiation, but how does it assure that it happens? And what happens if school districts enter into a discussion and decide not to pursue it? What happens? How does that? Is there penalties if they don't adopt a QCOMP program? Or I'm confused about the mandatory nature of this and how it works when you have also the provision that requires this to be negotiated.
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, that's a good question. What this does is the locals and the board still need to negotiate a plan and send it to the state. If for one reason one side decides not to enter into negotiations or a plan is not put together, and a later part of the bill I'll go over, the governor is proposing binding arbitration in lieu of a state salary freeze on school employees. And in that case, one side could bring a plan to the administrative law judge and have it part of the binding arbitration process.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Anderson, does the when you're talking about the principals, on page 2, line 15, you've added words instructional leadership. that is usually a common definition of the role of the principal. And I wondered if that what your meaning is there in the context of the QComp program.
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, part of the program has a component where teachers take on career ladders or career advancement options, and they become coaches, mentor teachers, and they really are providing instructional leadership to other teachers. And so I think the intent of that was to add a component of the plan that addresses how the district or the plan will have a professional development system that also focuses on instructional leadership of teachers, because having lead teachers and mentor teachers is a very strong part of the plan.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher, on the budget sheet, we have $41,452,000. What does that translate into in terms of new schools becoming part of QCOM?
Mr. Chairman and members, under current law, we're projecting that 43% of the students will be in school districts that are part of QComp in fiscal year 2011. Under this legislation, we're projecting that 70% of the students will be in school districts that are part of QComp, and that would grow to 75% in fiscal 2012 and to 80% in fiscal year 2013. So we have made some provision for not all districts getting there in terms of having a QComp plan approved by the fall of 2010.
And Deputy Commissioner, do you have adequate staff to handle the increase?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, staffing is always a recurring issue at the department. We feel at this time we have the infrastructure in place with our school improvement operation, working with us with service cooperatives around the state. We also, at this time, have full staffing in that division, which has been an issue because we've had a lot of attrition in that area as employees retire. So at this time, we're prepared to handle that increased demand just because we have a lot more knowledge and experience in implementing the program than we did when we started in 2005.
Okay. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Melcher, just going back to your point about the money, if by chance, and not that I'm too confident that would occur, but if it did occur that school districts took the mandatory requirement of this seriously, and they all submitted plans, and they all were plans that were approvable, what would the cost be, and how much would that require additional funding to be, how much additional funding would be necessary to make that work?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hanna, I'm kind of perusing my numbers here just to make sure I give you a correct answer. We have taken about $49 million out of the budget. So there's about a $49 million difference between what we're funding at 70% versus what it would cost at 100%. That's on a 100% aid entitlement basis, so you would take about 80% of that in the current biennium due to the 80-20 payment schedule.
So, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, so about another $50 million would be, roughly another $50 million would be necessary to fully do this if everybody complied.
That's Melcher. Correct. On a 100% basis, which would be in the second year that everybody complied. Okay. Yeah.
Senator Rummel? Okay. Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, I am uncomfortable with the difference between setting forward a mandatory policy and then planning for less than full compliance. There's just something about it that doesn't sit right. I understand that there's the practical reality, but it seems that if we really are serious about setting forward a policy, then we ought to establish a method for payment. So that's one thing. And then also, could you talk about when you put forward these numbers, what kind of an increase does that assume with regard to teacher salaries? When you look at, you know, implementing QComp, what is the average teacher experience in terms of an increase in their compensation? What are the assumptions in these numbers? Where does the increase in the numbers come from?
Thank you. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonnoff, this one's going to be thrown my way, I guess. When the program originally started, the $260 per student was based on a lot of different models across the country as to how much the how much a program that implements alternative teacher compensation in other areas would cost. In addition, the districts have approximately $100 per student for the staff development set aside, and so that has to be part of this program. As we looked at, that's $260 per student has been flat since 2005 when the program was implemented. So the governor's budget recommendation increases that by $40 per student to sort of make up for what hasn't happened since 2005 and also to provide increase to those existing districts that were in the program but won't benefit from this new revenue. So it provides them with a funding increase and also provides then $300 per student for the districts going into the program. In terms of salary assumptions, we based it really on cost and of hiring additional staff that's necessary and the professional development cost of having giving teachers time to engage in professional development activities. But there's not a basis that we say the costs are going X amount because it's a very – the plans are very different from district to district, and actually collective bargaining agreements are very different. What this – budget is, as you may know, the governor has proposed a salary freeze for all state and local employees in his budget. He did not propose that for school district employees. And so those increases will have to be negotiated locally. He did provide for, which we'll talk about in more detail later, a provision that allows for binding arbitration for impasses, that if you at a certain point in time a district or a local reaches an impasse, they can request binding arbitration. And they also have to go to binding arbitration at some certain point in time, so that negotiations are not taking place throughout an entire school year.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bonnoff.
Deputy Commissioner, it seems to me that when alternative pay systems or pay for performance, which really, you know, I don't know that you could call this because of this fact, are really effective, that you're able to give the people who are, you know, outstanding significant increases in pay. And so I'm also concerned that I remember being on this task force with the commissioner and with Representative Greiling, and we talked about how in the countries where they're seeing the greatest gains and the, you know, teacher quality huge strides is where there's been a strong commitment to increase the status of being a teacher and the entire pay scale. And so I'm concerned that while we say that we're taking on, you know, this in a revolutionary sort of way, you know, transforming Minnesota's system of education, I don't think that we are yet addressing some of the real structural problems in our pay scale for teachers. And so, you know, as somebody who's seen the benefits of this program, I'm a supporter, but I'm still concerned about the way that we're budgeting it and going about the expansion.
Okay. Senator Dahl and then Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Bonnoff's question, in a plan that we submitted 4 years ago that ultimately the teachers rejected and we did not submit to the Department of Education, it was average about $2,000 per year per teacher.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, is the reason that the governor did not include education in the freeze related to the QComp, in that there needs to be some flexibility? I noted as I was reviewing the bill, and I'm not sure exactly which section it's in, that you do make reference to some trying to increase the starting wage for teachers. So it was that when you say that you want this negotiated, is the elements of the QComp a factor in his not including education in the freeze?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. The governor recognizes that in order to recruit and retain highly qualified teachers, that we need to have more flexibility on compensation, but also recognizing that school districts are going to have limited budgets even if this proposal is adopted. And so in his proposal, he does not freeze, have a hard freeze or even a soft freeze on school employee wages, but rather provides for binding arbitration in his proposal so that if there's a situation where a school district just feels like they cannot afford the contract, they can go to a third party to make their case and have a third party make that decision.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is for Mr. Nauman. And Deputy Commissioner, what is the impact of QComp on these levy changes that you reviewed for us?
Mr. Chair and
Mr. Nauman.
Well, if you flip to the levy tracking, this is the second page one. We bundled them all in a single packet, hopefully to make things easier. Line 11, you'll notice it goes from line 11 to 16 for some reason.
Yes.
The levy change for alternative compensation is an increase of $12.2 million in taxes payable 2010, which is fiscal 11, and then it grows to 18.5 and 19.5, and I'm sure Dr. Melcher would suggest that those numbers are the levy effect associated with the growth that he described earlier.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, yes, that's correct. There's an increase in the additional levy as we have more districts participating in QComp. Also, the first-year number is a little low due to the timing of the levy. School districts have until the beginning of the school year to choose to go into the program, but that would be too late to make the property tax levy for the first year, so some districts would be making a catch-up levy in 2011, even though they might be entering the program.
And Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, Dr. Melcher, does the local levy stay constant? I think when QComp first started, it was around 20%. Now it's around 30%. Does the local levy portion of QComp stay constant, or does it change?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rummel, there was a change enacted by the legislature that, beginning in 2010, the local property tax share was increased. And after that, it stays, I think it's a 65-35% mixture of 65% aid, 35% levy. And that stays constant after 2010.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher, are there any changes related to the requirement for districts to levy in here if they have not utilized the full QComp levy?
Mr. Chairman and members, no. And we do have some school districts. I happen to live in South Washington County. They're in QComp. They've chosen not to levy. So, and this bill would not change that. A school district could opt to go into QComp. If they could do a QComp plan with only the state aid portion, then they're free to do that.
Deputy Commissioner or Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe we talked to Senator Olson, had a question about the change in Section 3 on lines 15. So going to Section 4.
This is the one we need to go.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 4 actually should be deleted from the bill. We're amending it in Section 4, and then we're repealing the same subdivision in Section 29. So it really should have an amendment at some point to take that out. This was just a technical amendment taking out the word site, and because of the mandatory nature of QComp, we would no longer have this transitional.
Okay. Senator Wieger moves to delete Section 4. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Section 5 of the bill, Subdivision 2 makes changes to comply with the mandatory change the governor is recommending, also that the start date of that is the 2010 and 11 school year, so the it's in the second year of the fiscal year. Number 3 basically proposes changing, basically clarifying the existing practice. This language adds language on the reforming the steps and lane salary schedule by adding this language by establishing an alternative schedule that utilizes methods other than seniority and fully or partially embeds performance pays as outlined in items I through 1 through 3. And so that is that provision 1 through 3 requires that school the performance pay be based on teacher evaluations first. Second, on school-wide performance gains, and 3, on other measures of student achievement as defined by the application submitted by the district and the exclusive representatives of teachers.
Senator Saltzman.
On this point, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if there's any information on when QComp is used. What percentage of the QComp money that comes from the state is used for embedded staff development versus the alternative salary schedule? Do we have any information on how schools are using those dollars? Because as we've heard about QComp, we've heard a lot about the staff development piece and how that we are hearing has been very helpful. The performance pay piece of it, I'm hearing from a lot of teachers who are on it, you know, I'm not really sure it's really doing anything, and why are we getting paid more to do what we're supposed to be doing? So is there any sort of information that's been collected on how the dollars are being used? Because I guess, wonder that with limited resources, should we really be targeting more money to the embedded staff development? And if districts want the performance pay, maybe that's the property tax levy. That's another discussion, but I'm just wondering if we had that kind of information.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, I think that'll be very difficult to collect in an accurate way because school districts have very different plans and to allocate different sorts of resources to meet the components of the plan. Also, when you look at the performance pay, it's part of an overall contract settlement. And so you have a district will have, for instance, federally funded employees, special ed, Title I, and they will use those federal funds to meet the compensation increases because they do not want to take state funds and cover it because then they have a maintenance of effort issue. Mm-hmm. So it's very complex in how it's done, and we've talked over the years of do we have a reserve for QComp, and the business managers did not want that because they felt it was be more cumbersome to administer the program. Also, in addition, the 2% staff development set aside is required to be aligned to the program and used as part of this program. So, for instance, you may have a district using all of their 2% set aside for the professional development activities and using QComp to hire additional teachers to be coaches and mentors. So it's going to vary a lot, very differently in each district. It's really based on the collective bargaining agreement they've reached with their locals. But we can try to get that information. Probably we have to go directly to the local districts because they actually keep track of it quite a bit. I think there's a lot of local accountability from the local unions as to how the district is spending the QComp dollars.
Thank you.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. And Ms. Anderson, on that section 5, two questions. One, just to clarify, this provision eliminates the lanes and step structure for compensation, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, this clarifies existing practice of the department in approving applications. We may have recalled we did have a court decision on this as it related to Sauk Center's application. Sauk Center wanted to keep steps and lanes and then take the QComp revenue and use it as an overlay over the system. But keep the underlying system intact. The commissioner disapproved the plan for that reason and for some other reasons, and saying that this program was intended to embed the, or at least partially embed, the performance pay aspects of QComp. The court decision was favorable to the department. And so we're really just clarifying existing practice. Now, school district may update its salary schedule to reflect inflationary increases, but the school has to develop a salary schedule that shows at least partially that they are embedding that the performance pay, which all of our fully approved plans currently do that. Now, how that's defined is up to the local plan, but the also confusion is as to the performance pay. There's several different ways a teacher can meet requirements, and a teacher may have three or four different opportunities to reach, let's say, as we talked about, $2,000. One teacher might get 1,000 of that because they met two of the goals. Another teacher may get all 2,000 of it. So it's a very tiered system as you go into some of those plans submitted and approved by the department.
And Mr. Chairman and Ms. Sanders,
Senator,
just again to clarify, are these provisions severable? In other words, if a school district fails to reach an agreement on a QCOM program, are they still required to change their salary schedule to comply with this provision 3 in this section? In other words, does it, regardless of whether they're able to do QCOM, are they required to change their salary schedule to reflect something other than just time and service?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, sort of like the contract settlement, a school district, you know, under that provision, they'll face a penalty if the school district doesn't settle a contract by a certain date. This is sort of if a school district and a local doesn't come up with the approved QCOM plan, they're not going to receive the $300 per student. So it's an incentive to settle a plan. If one party decides that they want to have a plan, they have an alternative option of going to binding arbitration. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get what they ask for, but at least they have an alternative if one side won't come to an agreement on a plan, or the two sides can't come to an agreement on a plan. So we do anticipate that 100% will not participate just because of circumstances. Every 2 years, 100% of our districts do not settle contracts. It's just sort of the nature of negotiations. Reasons may be both sides maybe want to forego the $300 per student and decide not to do it. You may have a plan that's not approved by the department as being meeting the parameters of the law. So there's several different reasons, and we're trying to account for that in the budget.
Deputy Commissioner, how will the department treat those districts that are currently in QComp compared to those that are coming in? It seems like the new language, and I could be wrong, but the existing agreements that districts have, at least from the report from the legislative auditor, was that there's as the program evolved, there's some things that the department has changed in terms of its, you know, approval process. So will the existing districts that may have been approved earlier have to follow the same new legislation as the ones that are coming in after?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think as the legislative auditor's report reflects is that when the program initially started, it was a very fast startup. We literally had a bill, I think, by mid-July, and the bill said by July 1st we had to be up and running. So we were already sort of 2 weeks behind as the bill was enacted. What has happened over time, and as we've learned more information from implementation and from input from our stakeholders, is that we needed to have a different procedure and process in place for approving applications. And so we've done that. Now, currently, those school districts that have fully approved QComp plans, this provision will not change their status. We do have some plans that are approved pending a final negotiation of their salary schedule. There's a few of those out there. I'm not sure how many. I would have to check. But for those that have fully approved plans, this does not, they would not have to resubmit a plan to the department unless they plan to substantially change their application.
So a different way to state the question is every district that's participating in QComp, it would be safe to say that there is none of them that would have a salary schedule that's based on seniority. Period.
Mr. Chair, not every school district has a fully approved plan. Some have an approved plan pending final negotiations of their salary schedule. So that really, the outlook of that is determinant on what their final product will be as their salary schedule. For those districts that have fully approved plans, the common way that those school districts meet that with their salary schedule, and this is not every school district, but it's very common among school districts, is that the employee doesn't move to the next level unless they have successfully completed their evaluation program throughout the year. So they have to have positive evaluations throughout the year as determined by the local plan in order to move forward as what one would call a step or a level. That's commonly how the district has complied with it. We do have variations of that. We have some that are a lot different than that, but that's a very common way that the school district has met this requirement.
I'm not sure I got a clear answer there, though. In all of the agreements that the department has, seniority cannot be a factor in terms of the pay or the salary schedule.
Mr. Chair, for those fully approved plans, simply being there another year, i.e. seniority, is not the only factor. And the idea is that this is not a one-time overlay over the system, that this needs to be, there needs to be some performance for moving forward on the steps. And how school districts meet that typically is by using the evaluation system to determine if a teacher should move forward on the salary schedule or not.
It's not automatic.
So, Mr. Chair, for an example, I guess just to use an example, if a teacher is on step four, and the plan says that the order for the teacher to move to step five, that he or she needs to have three satisfactory evaluations throughout the year. If that teacher has three satisfactory evaluations throughout the year, then that teacher moves to the next step. Versus the old plan, the teacher would have moved to that step just by being there one more year.
Okay, that's what I thought too, except so we have there are no approved plans that exist where teachers would automatically get an increase or that it would include steps and lanes.
Mr. Chair, no fully approved plans. Like I said, there's some plans that they're still negotiating their salary schedule, so I can't speak to the outcome of what will happen on those cases. But you may have a district that every 2 years updates their salary schedule to reflect inflation. So the beginning salary will move up higher, the ending salary will move up higher, and in between they move those steps up higher. But that is simply updating the salary schedule. That doesn't change. The teacher has to move from, as I mentioned, step four in this case to step five based on performance on the evaluations.
Okay, I'm not sure.
So the salary schedule doesn't remain static for years. School districts do update their salary schedule to reflect inflation.
All right. I guess the point I was trying to get at, and I'm not sure because I don't know all of the plans, but is that if we eliminate the steps and lanes, if this language were to become law and we eliminate the steps and lanes, that I think it would be unfair for some districts to have been approved to have steps and lanes just because they were in earlier than all the rest of them who would have to not be able to have steps and lanes. I guess I just want to be sure that the fairness is there for all districts.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be helpful. We could provide the committee with the list of approved plans and their salary schedules so you can take a look at each district and how they would meet this requirement on their plans. I think that would be helpful because it's hard to talk and it's difficult to speak in generalities when plans are very different and negotiated.
Sure.
Details are different. I'm just trying to speak in generality for all 44 school district plans, and that's sometimes difficult to explain.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Anderson, this page four is where that statement that I raised earlier about improving beginning teacher salaries, that's a part of that same sentence. What do you mean by improving beginning teacher salaries? Have you got some vision of what that is? Under normal negotiations, I you know, the beginning salary normally goes up whatever percentage the whole schedule does. Is that, does that constitute improvement, or do you have a criteria that is different than that in terms of a stronger elevation of the beginning teacher salary?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, by that statement, we're trying to make a policy statement and directive to locals to negotiate improvements on beginning salary schedules. It's been part of a national movement by NEA and AFT to move beginning teacher salaries to $40,000 per year. We do have some school districts in Minnesota meeting that requirement. That does not say we will put that criteria onto school districts. We will not. We will allow the local plans to determine how they've improved beginning teacher salaries.
Thank you.
Okay, Deputy Commissioner or Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, moving to, again, on page 5, line 13, we've stricken the word site-based and included more generally job-embedded professional development to provide districts with more flexibility as they move into the mandatory provision. Section 6, subdivision 2, again, strikes, moves to the mandatory requirement by striking school sites and requiring all school districts. Lines, starting with lines 32, the department is striking language. This was part of a legislative audit report recommendation. This language required the department to convene a review committee of teachers and administrators within 30 days of receiving the application to recommend to the commissioner whether to approve or disapprove the application. This has been difficult to administer. It's very difficult to get teachers and administrators in to review applications. The review of those applications is part of the reasons why we've had uneven application of the law, at least at the beginning. The legislative auditor recommended removing this provision, this language in law, so we have taken his recommendation. I will note that in replace of that, so we do have some feedback coming from our stakeholders. If you go to the next page, or I'm sorry, if you stay on page 5, lines 29, certain lines 29 and then going to page 6, we've added an advisory council for the commissioner. The advisory council must include representatives of the Department, Education Minnesota, the Minnesota Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Minnesota Rural Education Association, MSBA, the Minnesota Business Partnership, and the Chamber of Commerce. And this committee is required to meet at least quarterly to review and monitor implementation of this section, to monitor and evaluate the results and effectiveness of the program, and report annually to the appropriate committees in the House and Senate.
Deputy Commissioner, does the department have a cost on the advisory council?
Mr. Chairman, we actually currently do have advisory council that does meet and provides a similar role. What we will likely do is take that existing advisory council and refocus them on the priorities written into the statute. But we do have a council that does meet at least once every 3 months. In addition, we do not provide per diem or mileage for that council, so it's the membership of that council is voluntary.
What's the difference between the current advisory council and the one that you're proposing here?
Mr. Chair, the current advisory council has been more of stakeholders from the education organizations and also from the school districts that talk about individual implementation. They'll talk about best practices that they're using. We do have discussions about the application process. What we would envision is that we would probably refocus this council to not only deal with those areas, but actually look at individual plans that the department is approving before they go to the commissioner or disapproving before they go to the commissioner, and deal more with the procedures and processes of the application. So what we would do is sort of either expand the role or refocus the role to focus on the department's implementation of the program rather than right now it's pretty well focused on best practices and sharing information with one another as stakeholders.
And Deputy Commissioner, couldn't the advisory council or the department do that without having new authority?
Mr. Chairman, we're certainly willing to do that. I know that there's some interested parties that want to have some language and counsel and language on this program. And so we're just trying to strike the balance between both of those.
Okay. This if this stays in, it means that the legislation would have to go to another committee.
Mr. Chairman, we're willing to take it out. We'll have the council, regardless if the legislature passes the language or not. We already do that already. So we just want to reflect that as we're removing a provision that has teachers and administrators reviewing applications, that we have some sort of fallback on that provision.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner, I appreciate that you're responding to the auditor's report and removing that part about having the different people reviewing it. I am then concerned about the rollout and the numbers of school districts now submitting applications in terms of the process for reviewing applications. Who will then be reviewing them, and how do you think that will really work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, the legislative auditor recommended that department staff conduct the initial review and make recommendation, and then what our anticipation is that we would bring applications to the advisory council for discussion in terms before they go to the commissioner for approval or disapproval. What the difficult part actually in implementing this is the 30 days, because I'll give you an example. We received applications in mid-December, several applications in mid-December of last year, and we had to review them in 30 days, and trying to get teachers and administrators to come in during Christmas break and then ask them to take time off of school during the first week of January when they're back in class was very difficult. And it's very difficult to get, and we don't actually know. It's a rolling application process, so we're not sure when we're going to receive applications. And in this case, we received several applications at once, versus we could go a long time without receiving an application. So what the next language attempts to do is have the give the commissioner authority to establish submission deadlines. So we're well aware of we can staff and have the ability to plan staffing time around receipt of applications rather than they show up. We have five that show up on our door one day, and then we have the 30-day timeline triggers it for review. Also, as the legislative auditor reported, that the department staff have more consistently apply the statute. Right now we have a pool of probably 50 or more teachers and administrators that come in. Sometimes they are not able to, they can review the application on the front end, but then they, if their application requires revision by the local school district, they can't be part of that process at the end. So we have to bring in new reviewers that didn't have the knowledge up front of what the application was. So the legislative auditor recognized how the difficulty of implementing that provision. So what we've done is replace that is first have a submission deadline process so we can allocate work resources and know when applications are required to come in. And then the second thing is have an advisory council that can meet quarterly, at least quarterly, and provide us with feedback on the implementation, the process, and the approval or disapproval of applications.
On that same or in that same vein, on page 5, Clause B at the top of the page, 5.10. Do we need that 30 days? I thought the legislative auditor, in talking about this, suggested that the 30 days wasn't exactly necessary on either side, especially if those applications come in, you know, quarterly or semi-annual. So I'm just wondering if that was overlooked or if there was a purpose for that 30 days.
Mr. Chairman, actually that was likely overlooked. What we could do is strike lines 9 through 13. I'd like to keep 7 and 8, where it says if the commissioner disapproves an application, the commissioner must give the applicant timely notice of specific reasons and detail for approving the application. But what I'd like to do is, instead of deleting it now, is maybe come up with revised language that allows them to resubmit their application for revision, because I do I would not want a situation where, let's just say, they could easily correct deficiencies in the application within a timely manner and still receive the aid. So I'd like to still have a revision process for school districts, but perhaps the 30-day can be removed from that process.
Mr. Chairman.
Your hand.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. You'd mentioned that if this language in Section 8 stays in, that the bill would have to go to another committee. What other committee would have jurisdiction over this?
Senator Rest Committee.
which, Mr. Chairman, which committee is that?
State and local government.
And that's because it would create an advisory council, even though we have one in existence. It would, the way I was reading this is taking an existing body and doing something differently with it, but that would still need approval of. Okay, all right.
That's correct. That's why it would be easier.
That's a nice friendly committee. We could get answered more quickly.
I'm sure we could find a few friendly faces on there. Senator Clark.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Anderson, I was wondering, just to be clear, so everybody will be doing these things, and you've got the timelines and everything else, and I should thank you again for working with my district. It's one, for people who don't know, St. Cloud School District is still working.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
St. Cloud School District is still working on their compensation piece, and the department's been good about working with them. But if we're going statewide, I might have been missing this. Are there penalties? What happens if a district doesn't do this? Is the penalty the money? Is the penalty, what's the penalty if the district is not in compliance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Clark, the penalty is they're not, that school district is not eligible for $300 per student, which is about a 5% increase in revenues.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Clark,
and Deputy Commissioner, if a district decided that this was not necessarily enhancing what they were doing, or they felt that it wasn't making changes, they could the penalty would be they just wouldn't get the money. There is no other penalty. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Clark, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Did I miss anyone in terms of having your hands up? Okay. Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Section 7 just reflects changes to the mandatory proposal by the governor, and then we went over subdivision 5 on pages 5 and 6 on the advisory council. So I will have Dr. Melcher talk about the funding piece of the proposal.
Chairman and members, Section 9 is increasing the QCOMP allowance from $260 per pupil to $300 per pupil beginning in fiscal year 2011. Deleting references to school sites because it would be required that the districts implement this on a district-wide basis as opposed to site by site. Section 10 is, again, deleting some of the language relating to school sites, but the primary change on page 7, lines 26 through 8.2 is eliminating the portion of the cap on QCOMP revenue that relates to charter schools. Section 11 of the bill is the property tax shift. This is the same language that was enacted by the legislature in 2003. It creates a 48.6% property tax shift, so most of the first half property tax settlement would be recognized by school districts in the year when they receive it, rather than the districts holding the revenue until July 1st and recognizing it on July 1st. Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet, line 15, this is the item that triggers the $570 million of one-time savings in the budget due to the aid reduction that offsets the earlier recognition of the property tax money.
Excuse me, Senator Bonhoff. Members, don't be apologetic for asking questions. So please, if I don't catch your hand right away, I will over time. Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Dr. Melcher, I have to go back for a moment. With regard to the QCOMP funding on page 6, line 28, talking about the intermediate school districts, perhaps I missed this, but you're talking about the formula that we would use for intermediate school districts, and I carried the bill earlier last week with regard to the fact that they don't have pupils assigned to their district, and so we had to come up with a new formula. When this refers to a different section, how are we calculating QCOMP for intermediates?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, the governor's bill does not reflect the change that was in your bill that would convert the calculation for intermediates from a per pupil per teacher rate. So under current law, the intermediates are funded based on a rate per pupil like other school school districts are, and we recognize that that generates less money per teacher than what the school districts typically receive.
Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, I'm confused because I thought that in the intermediates, they don't actually, you know, their pupils belong to other districts, so then are you suggesting that with the way this calculates it, it's just the person who's in that school is considered the resident pupil, and then how do you calculate it if they're only in the school for part of the day? It seems to me that if, in fact, we are serious about including intermediates, that the language in the bill ought to reflect what you actually have come up with as the more fair way to allocate QComp to the intermediates. Are you open, Deputy Commissioner? Are you open to having an amendment to this to reflect Dr. Melcher's earlier formula?
Mr. Chair, Deputy Senator Bonhoff, we're certainly willing to consider that proposal, and we have worked with the lobbyists associated with the intermediate school districts. I will say we're very concerned that there might maybe a cost, so we really actually want to work on that language to make sure that it wouldn't generate an additional cost in the governor's budget because we'd have to reflect that. But we're certainly willing to work with you.
And Mr. Senator Chairman, Bonhoff. Dr. Melcher, what the way that it's currently written, how are you establishing the pupils' eligibility?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, the intermediate school districts do count some pupils. If there's a student enrolled there full-time, for example, in an area learning center program operated by the intermediate school district, or some special education students might be going full-time to the intermediate, that is considered their primary school, and so they do generate pupil units at the intermediate school district for those students. But students who are primarily enrolled in another school and they only go there for an hour or two, those students are counted in the home school and not in the intermediate. And in the analysis of your bill, we did find that as a result of the combination of the part-time students not being included and just the nature of intermediate district programs where you have a high proportion of students with high-cost programs, that the staffing is such that the rate per pupil in the existing formula provides less per teacher than the school districts typically receive. We recognize that.
Senator Thank Bonhoff. You, Mr. Chairman. So, Deputy Commissioner, I would ask that you give serious consideration to having the intermediates be reflected in a different way.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, you indicated that the increase from $260 to $300 would be going into effect in the 2011 school year.
Dr. Melcher. Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, yes. On page 7, line 4, you see the effective date is effective for revenue for fiscal year 2011. That's the 2010-2011 school year, second year of the biennium.
So, Mr. Chairman, then it would stay. I was wondering if there was going to be a gap there, but then the current language would be in place for the next year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that's correct. Yes, it would stay at 260 for 2010.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, how much in total are we spending on this proposal, this portion of the proposal?
Chairman, Dr. Melcher. Rummel, on the spreadsheet, the QCOM expansion is $41.5 million in the current biennium, and it goes to about $53 million in 2012 and $55 million in 2013. We have not broken out here, but we could calculate the what the impact is of going from 260 to 300 versus the impact of the mandate, but I don't have that information with me. That's your question.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, does that include the levy increase to property taxes?
Dr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, no. This is the state aid appropriation impact, and the levy impact is later on in Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet that we had reviewed earlier. That was, I believe, 12.2 million for taxes payable in 2010 and 18 $19.5 million for taxes payable in 2011 and $19.5 million for taxes payable in 2012.
Senator Romo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, Deputy Commissioner, can you remind me again what is it we expect to get from this policy change? In the next year alone, we'll be spending, looks like, $53+ million. What is it we're going to see as a result of this policy change?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, there's a large body of research about improving the effectiveness of teachers in the classroom and how that increases student achievement. What this program does is focuses on teachers on several different aspects. One includes is compensation, but others include professional development, teacher evaluations, and what the ultimate goal is to try to strengthen our teaching workforce. And we know that from a lot of research that if we have stronger teachers in the classroom, their students are going to perform better. So the sole focus of this program is to try to improve teacher instruction, which will lead to improved student achievement.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner, in the auditor's report, we did not really get much indication. He found it very difficult to be able to extract the evidence that, in fact, that was affecting student achievement. I mean, it seems like a large investment before we have any really hard evidence that this will make that kind of a difference.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to mention the auditor's report reflected the difficulty in doing that for several reasons. One is the amount of time that the school districts have been in place has not been that long. The second is the voluntary nature of the program. It's difficult to compare that against control schools when you're controlling basically the voluntary schools. They may be high-performing schools anyways. You're not really quite sure of that. The third issue I will relay to you is that if we can't extract student achievement in educational programs in this setting, then I don't think we could do it for any program, which I think is wrong. I think that we can look at programs in education. They may not be as highly correlated as other areas that you look at, but you can find correlations. And Dr. Marzano has done a large body of research as to looking at teacher effectiveness and what improves teacher effectiveness, and has found that having an effective teacher in the classroom is the largest indicator of improving student achievement other than the home life and the parents. I think in his research he found a 49% impact on parents and found a 43% impact on the teacher in the classroom. So what we're attempting to do is try to focus and improve our teachers in several different ways, but that's the focus of the program, and we will continue to evaluate the effectiveness of this program. I think for the $49+ million we've spent on this program, I think we've evaluated it much more than we've evaluated other programs in education. But we'll continue that because we think that's important to look at the performance of the program. And if over time we find the program is ineffective, then the legislature should remove funding.
Seems to me that
Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that over time we should see if it's effective and then invest in the program.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Rummel has a good point, and I agree with that, and I would hope we'd apply that to other programs like compensatory aid, for example, as well.
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 12 on page 9, line 6, is changing the calculation of the minimum length of the school year for charter schools to reflect the hours rather than days that we were proposing in Article 1, Section 1 of the bill. Section 13 is adding a cross-reference to the pay-for-progress revenue in the list of components of general education revenue that the charter schools qualify for. Section 14 would exclude the pay-for-progress revenue from the calculation of special education tuition billing adjustments, so the pay-for-progress revenue would stay with the resident school district. Section 15 does the same sort of thing with special education aid. The pay-for-progress revenue would be excluded from the calculation of the excess cost aid, so the districts would not be penalized in the special ed aid they get because they were getting paper progress revenue. Section 16 is also relating to the paper progress revenue getting cross-referenced in the calculation of the special education excess cost revenue. And section 17 is another reference in terms of the calculation of out-of-state tuition, again, adding a cross-reference to the paper progress revenue, as is section 18. Section 19 is the provision of the bill that relates to the $10,000 savings that Mr. Nauman is showing on his spreadsheet on line 9. It is basically limiting the extended time revenue to school districts that have extended time programs in the current fiscal year and not providing a 1 year of additional funding after the district has discontinued its program. Section 20 is reflecting the change from $260 to $300 per pupil as the rate for the calculation of QComp revenue in the QComp aid formula. And lines page 15, lines 3 through 6 are eliminating the cap on QComp funding so that the funding would be driven by the actual participation and not limited to the $75 million in current law. Section 21 is the actual provision which defines the pay-for-progress revenue. This would start in fiscal year 2010 and would include school districts and charter schools. And the calculation would be based 1% of the formula allowance times the percent of students who are achieving medium growth plus 2% of the formula allowance times the percentage of students who are achieving high growth based on the growth model. Section 22 is dealing with the reduction of aid for school districts that do
Mr.
not provide
Chairman.
The required minimum number of hours of instruction.
We have a question. Back. Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, this I've been looking forward to hearing more about the pay for progress revenue because I haven't seen the new growth model. So I don't know, you know, when we talk about 1%, you know, compared to medium growth versus high growth, and there were so many discussions last session with regard to is growth measured compared to the norm, compared to the standard. When we talk about medium growth, what are we talking about? So is this the appropriate time to go through that, or can we make sure that we reserve? Because I don't think we can really evaluate and understand this provision in the bill without really understanding the new growth model.
Senator Bonhoff, that's a good question.
Mr. Chairman and members, Dr. I need Melcher. To defer to Deputy Commissioner Anderson or our testing people.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, would you mind deferring this and we can have a more fuller presentation and try to bring up the growth model on a PowerPoint and maybe possibly the end of today or tomorrow? Just because I feel like people need to see it in order to understand the percentages that otherwise people, I don't think we'll give them a good sense of how this program will work.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good idea. I just want to make sure that we didn't slide over this like it was a little thing because, it, you know, hearing about the new growth model is a pretty big deal, and then having pay associated with the new growth model is an even bigger deal. And so I do look forward to a very full discussion on it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we're going to try to get it onto the PowerPoint here and then have Dr. Mattson go through it. So just to provide you with more detail.
Okay. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. So that's a good point, Senator Bonhoff and Mr. Chair. But I guess I have a question is that if QComp and performance pay is rewarding teachers for performance, is this sort of like another pay for performance on top of something that's already paying for performance? Because I see where you're going with this, but it seems like it's sort of double dipping in a way, in that we're, you know, providing dollars for schools to, again, pay teachers to do what I would argue they're supposed to be doing. And here, if we're rewarding school districts for growth, which is probably a good deal, that are those dollars going again toward a teacher's salary, or how are we using it? So I guess with limited dollars, feels like we sort of have some dollars going to the same kind of goal. So I guess that's probably we can discuss that when we look at the growth model. But I do see it as sort of providing dollars for the same kind of incentives.
Mr. Chairman,
Deputy Commissioner,
Senator Saltzman, the governor wanted to, in his budget, to provide additional funding to school districts, albeit limited. In exchange for that, just given the circumstances of the budget, he wanted to have school districts show some progress for performance. The QCOMP revenues is specifically for teachers. It's to improve teacher instruction. It's not just about pay. It's about professional development, about hiring additional staff to assist with other teachers. This is specifically pay for progress. We won't call it performance because it's based on showing growth for your students for school districts. And so it's a more of a broader accountability. So the governor felt that for additional revenues, he wanted a system for school districts to earn that increase. The school districts, once they receive the funding, are free to spend it however they wish, as if it's general fund dollars. And so there's no restrictions on that versus the QCOMP money is very specific as to how those revenues can be spent.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, I think the districts that have been in QCOMP have faced some of the same kind of challenges that the rate of increase that we have given them on the formula hasn't necessarily prevented them from having to make cuts in their overall budget. So, the 2% can be appealing, and it is just saying that there has to be some evidence of growth in relation to adding that amount of money to the formula.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that would be a correct assessment.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Nauman can answer. I'm just trying to reconcile the bill with the spreadsheet we've got in front of us. And is the pay for progress piece in Section 21, line 11, which we're calling pay for performance plan, is that the dollar amount reflected?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Koch, yeah, that's exactly right. I think when the governor first announced it, he talked about a pay for performance plan, and we built the spreadsheet based on that. When the language was developed, it followed several weeks later, and they changed the name.
Okay. Dr. Melcher, could you I don't know if you finished with Section 22 or not, but could you give me an idea of what kind of a savings there might be?
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 22 is the aid penalty for school districts that did not comply with the minimum number of hours of instruction, and this is new language, but it goes back and reflects the language that we had in law back when we had a penalty before the mid-1990s. We are not carrying a savings for this because we think school districts will, in fact, comply and provide the minimum number of hours of instruction. Back before the penalty was repealed in the early 90s, it was standard practice for school districts if they had 171 days on their calendar and they had two snow days, they'd make up one to make sure they didn't get penalized in terms of their general education aid. And we think they'll do that again. Right now what happens is they have 171 days, they have two snow days, there's no incentive to make up the day because they're getting the same pay anyway. So this just kind of goes back to where we were before. We don't have a history in the past of having actually made reductions. It just kind of creates a little bit more accountability to the school districts that they need to make up time if they lose days due to snow days or whatever. So we're not booking a savings in the budget for this.
Dr. Melcher, this is kind of an ounce of prevention.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Those districts that might be tempted.
We think that they will make up the days as they have historically when we had the penalty in law. Mr. Chairman, members, Section 23 is adding a cross-reference to the new paragraph on the property tax shift that creates the 48.6% tax shift. Section 24 is the change in the payment schedule, page 17, line 3, from 90% to 80%. Cross-referencing to Mr. Nauman's spreadsheet again, if you go to line 14, you'll see the impact of that within the general education portion of the budget is $570 million, but then there are other lines for this as it affects other programs. The next section, Section 25, is a technical change. It's deleting an obsolete payment schedule that applied to fiscal year 2004. Section 26 is the provision that the governor's recommending for advance final payments for school districts and statutory operating debt. This is parallel to what we did in 2003 when we did the 80-20 payment shift. So those school districts that are in statutory operating debt would still be able to qualify for up to 90% of their general education aid. We're recognizing that they have more serious cash flow problems as a result of the payment shift than other school districts. That would be limited to $7.5 million a year, which is smaller than what we did in 2003 because we have fewer school districts in statutory operating debt now.
Is there any indication of the problems that districts might experience with the amount of the shift that the governor's proposing?
Mr. Chairman and members, we think that this will result in some lost interest earnings to school districts and that it will result in some additional borrowing for school districts that have relatively low fund balances. I know there's been some testimony in this committee indicating there would be some impact. Given the current environment in terms of interest rates being extremely low, this is actually an opportune time to do something like this because the impact is much less than it would be if districts were making 5 or 6% on their money. But we know this is a concern. It's a lot of savings to the state budget and on a one-time basis. And we think that this is manageable for the school districts, but we think that the districts in statutory operating debt need a little bit of extra help because they are affected more than others.
Do you have any kind of a number in mind as to the amount of borrowing that districts might have to enter into? And then last night when the president was giving his speech, I've heard it several times that it's difficult to access credit. And if districts have to borrow, do we have any assurances that the credit is going to be there for them?
Mr. Chairman, you got a couple questions there. We do not have a number calculated in terms of the amount of interest cost or the amount of borrowing districts would have to do. Certainly, we could go back and look at 2003 to see what the changes were at that time. We have not heard from districts that they anticipate problems borrowing. We do have our credit enhancement program at the state, which I think is very helpful to school districts as they do borrowing. But I think it might be helpful at some point along the way to get testimony from the school boards or the Superintendents Association in terms of how they see that impacting them.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Melcher, I know that we are not reflecting the changes based on the stimulus package in this budget, that this budget is assuming the budget prior to getting that stimulus package. And so I think we have heard that, in fact, the shift may not be able to be quite as robust if we are to accept the stimulus dollars because of the maintenance of effort. Is my understanding correct, or... what do you see with regard to that?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, we have not received any indication at this point that we cannot do this shift. Our expectation is, and this is ultimately up to the commissioner of the Minnesota Management and Budget Area to put together the overall coordination of the stimulus plan. But my understanding from discussions we've had so far is that when we apply for the stimulus dollars, we expect that we'll be calculating maintenance of effort based on an entitlement basis rather than on a appropriation basis reflecting shifts. And we hope that the federal authorities will understand the logic and wisdom of doing it that way.
Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, Would you anticipate that we build bills in the legislature based on entitlements with an eye towards the 2006 entitlement versus the appropriation?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, I think it hopefully we'll get a quick response from the federal government, and that should be well before the end of the legislative session, so we'll have a much better figure going in. But I think at this point our expectation is that we will apply based on entitlements, and that will be considered acceptable by the federal government as it relates to calculation of maintenance of effort. It's what we've done with our special education maintenance of effort in the past. So we think that we will be okay there. We don't want to put ourselves at risk of having the federal government tell us that we owe them $800 million. So we want to get good information, and we think we'll get that before the end of the session, before the final bills need to be put together.
Good. Right. Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 27 is removing an obsolete reference to an aid payment calculation from 2005. And then Section 28 is the appropriations for the general education and related programs. So the major changes, again, here that are reflected in the appropriations are the expansion of QCOMP, the increase in QCOMP from $260 to $300 per pupil, and the pay for progress revenue. You will see that a number of the sections of law that are in the current base budget are reflected here. For example, the continuation of the compensatory revenue pilot program, the one-time flood money for Rushford, Peterson, and so forth. And then finally, Section 29 is the repealer section, and the first two repealers are dealing with pieces of the QCOMP legislation that are not needed if the program becomes a mandatory statewide program. And the third one, the 123B.05, would be the repeal of the January 15th teacher contract deadline, which does carry a cost of, I believe, $500,000. Because there are some districts that, in fact, are penalized.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Dr. Melcher, could you just give me a one positive from the January 15th deadline repealer? You did say it would have a cost because the schools are penalized if they go beyond January 15th deadline. And it's very clear, since we have had in statute and not in statute a January 15th deadline, that there are only a handful of schools that actually fail to reach a collective bargaining agreement when, in fact, there is a deadline in place.
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, the repealer of the $25 per student contract settlement deadline corresponds with what we're doing with the binding arbitration. So in the binding arbitration, we're actually, I think, requiring a contract settlement or a decision by the administrative law judge by December 1. So it wouldn't make sense to have the January 15th deadline, because that's prior, or that's after the judge must make a decision if it does go to binding arbitration. So we felt as if that penalty becomes obsolete because of the governor's proposal on binding arbitration, which we'll go through at the end of the bill.
Thanks.
Dr. Melcher, could you just give the page reference?
Mr. Chairman, we're at beginning Article 2 on page 21 of the bill, and I believe we have some other folks that are going to be involved in this article.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we go on to that, would you give me some background on the compensatory revenue pilot project? I don't know who to ask.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, it might be easier for me to do that. I think it was maybe 2005. This was a program that was initiated as part of the House K-12 bill. And in negotiations, it was ultimately accepted by the governor and signed, accepted by the Senate and signed into law. It, in 2007, I believe, received some slight expansions. You'll recall that we had a bill from Senator Jungbauer a couple weeks ago to essentially maintain current law. Mm-hmm. They had produced a report, as is required under the law, to speak to the benefits of allocating compensatory revenue in the manner that's provided here. But it's clear that this is additional dollars to these districts for compensatory purposes.
Okay.
Why is those all?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're going to go back to the pay for progress proposal, and I'm going to have Dr. Mattson give an overview of the growth model because that's what we're paying based on, so members have an understanding of how the payments will work based on the growth model. Members may not know that the department did release, came to an agreement with stakeholders and released the growth model on its state report cards, I think, in December of last year. And so Dr. Mattson, we'll go over that briefly so members have an understanding.
Dr. Mattson?
Mr. Chair, members, Dirk Mattson with assessment for the department. I'm going to cover very briefly. The full presentation would probably be 30, 45 minutes, so I will try and get this down to 2 to 3 minutes, and we'll see, and we can certainly make the full PowerPoint or a larger conversation available and take what questions you have. Essentially, what this growth model is based on in some ways is kind of an actuarial table. It's saying, based on how students actually perform from 1 year to the next, how much growth can we expect? And so I'm going to walk you through I'm going to show you some pictures than I am going to walk you through slides. But essentially it was based on, and stakeholders had conversation about, the principles behind it. It should be empirically based, so it was modeled after 2 years' worth of data. The targets should be fair, and there was much conversation about what is fair, and certainly that's a word that bears definition, but I believe that stakeholders found agreement on that. And then that they should be meaningful, meaning that they have some, teachers have some knowledge of what that means for students in their classroom and certainly districts as well. So I'm going to, I hope to skip a little bit about this, but let me try and, I'm dancing without a net a little bit here and moving quickly. What we have, a third grade student who had a 339 on the MCA2 test. They're in the does not meet level. They'd have to be at 340 to get partially meets, et cetera. What would we, meets is 350. So what would we expect to see for that student's growth? What would be meaningful growth for that student? And then I want to quickly jump to actually the picture, and I will try and explain the picture a little better than walking through the text of the slides. Essentially, we looked at every score point from, for example, a third grade student to a fourth grade student, that same fourth grade student in the following year. And we did this for 2 years in a row. And we identified where do those students tend to wind up? Where is their, what kind of growth do we expect to see? Based on that, if looking at the whole, we identified students kind of in this middle, look at the columns first, students were making typical growth, growth that was expected based on that 2 year look back, and finding where those students are. So they're making medium growth, if you will. Students that are performing better than that, that are out exceeding that by half a standard deviation. So looking at how students performed as a whole, perhaps the bulk of them are lumped up in that middle column. Students that are beyond that are in the far right. They're exceeding what typical students were doing in their growth for those 2 years when we looked at those scores overall. And so those students were making exceptional progress in that column. And then in the far left column, students who were not making that growth, were not reaching that. And again, we looked at some statistical distributions, and we said if it's less than a half a standard deviation, if it's farther out, those tails of what you typically see for the normal bell curve, if they're farther out on the tails, they're not making the growth that we would expect them to meet proficiency. And so that established the columns that are in that table. Also, students were separated into, are you already proficient? We expect you to make, you're going to make growth in one of those three areas, either the growth that typical students would make, exceeding growth, exceptional growth, or limited growth in the far left. But when you started and you entered into a teacher's classroom, you were either proficient on last year's test or you were not. That's a binary decision. You were either proficient or not. And so what we hope to have happen, or what we certainly want to have happen, is that students who are making typical progress in the center top cell, that's a good thing. We want them to at least continue with that, or we want them to make exceptional progress in the top right cell for those students who are proficient. In the top left cell, students who were proficient but made no growth or limited growth, that's good they were proficient last year, but at the trajectory they're on, they're going to start slipping backwards. So that's not a cell where we would want a lot of students to be in. Going across the bottom, you have kind of the same trajectories there. students who are either not making, if they're not proficient and they're still not meeting growth according to what would be expected, that's not our target. Nor if they made a typical year's worth of growth in the center bottom cell, but they weren't proficient, they're going to be not proficient the following year as well. So what it is the three columns here from the center top, the right top, and the bottom right are the three cells that we are hoping that students will wind up in. And again, this is just a look at how students performed and identifying that. So here's the measures applied at the state level. And I anticipate you may not be able to see the numbers in great detail, and we can certainly make the slides available to you. In mathematics, just looking at mathematics for the entire state, those students who were making what we expected growth and were proficient, 27.9%. And again, the other two favored cells where they're making adequate, I don't want to use the term adequate progress, they're making what we expect for growth in the upper right cell, 19.3%. They were proficient last year, and they've exceeded the expectations of where we expected those students to wind up. And then the bottom right cell, 11.9% there for mathematics. These students were not proficient last year, but they have accelerated a rate greater than what we expected them to do. So those are the three cells that certainly are the focus of where we are. And so the plan that's listed in there is dealing with 1% in that center column and then 2% in the far right. And I might defer to the Deputy Commissioner on the details of that dollar amounts there, how that's spread out. Reading is the same thing. Again, the three favored cells that we're looking for is the 29.7, the top center, the top right at 21.9, and the bottom right at 10.1. And that, in a nutshell, is how it's how the calculation is done.
Do you have to meet both proficiency in math and reading, or in order to access
it's growth.
It's growth.
Growth.
But growth in both.
But do you have to have growth in both to access the revenue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. Under the governor's proposal for pay for progress, a student doesn't have to be proficient, but does have to either achieve medium or high growth in both math and reading to qualify for the increase.
So you're saying that they have to have medium or high growth in both?
In both subject areas, correct, Mr. Chair. Both math and reading.
And now that's tied to the
MCAs. Mr. Chair, members, if I can correct what I just told you, my apologies. What we do, because all students are not tested, is we take the average percentage of students tested in each subject area who scored at medium or high growth to calculate the pay for progress funding for school
what's
districts.
What's the average student?
Turning it over to Dr. Melcher.
What I'm trying to do is tie it back to what the fiscal projection was.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The way that the calculations would work is that we look at the percentage of the district students that were tested in math, and let's say that was that achieved medium growth, and the percentage that were tested in math that achieved high growth. We also look at the students that were tested in reading and the percentage that achieved medium growth and the percentage that achieved high growth. You don't necessarily have the students being tested in both subjects because they're different grade levels, et cetera. So what we're looking at here is if the district had, let's say, 40% of its students that were tested in math achieving medium growth in math and 42% of its students that were tested in reading achieving medium growth in reading, we take the average of the 40% in math, the 42% in reading, we get 41%. The funding would then be providing a 1% increase in general education funding times the 41%, which is the average of the students that were at the medium growth level, to generate the amount of funding that would go out. We do the same thing with the high growth. If 30% of the students were achieving high growth in math and 34% were achieving high growth in reading, we're taking the average of the 34% in reading and the 30% in math. That would be a 32% average between the two, and we would be basing the 2% times the 32% average between the two. But we're not tying this to the individual student and looking at whether they were achieving high growth in both subjects. We're looking at the aggregate district level data in terms of the percentage of tested students that were at a certain level, averaging the level of proficiency or the level of growth in the two test areas for the district, and then applying the funding mechanism in that manner.
Okay. And does that revenue then go to the site where they're tested, or does it follow with the students, or does it go to the district?
Mr. Chairman and members, the bill is written so that it goes to the school district.
Okay. And Senator Bonhoeff and then Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Melcher, some of the biggest flaws with regard to No Child Left Behind is when, as you know, is when we're testing cohorts of students and then making assumptions that aren't following the individual student. And so now that I'm listening to you, I'm still concerned that we're doing that. So, for example, when you say there's growth, is this growth because you tested a student in third grade and that student was at one point, and then you tested that student in fourth grade and they were at a different point, and so now you've established growth of that student, and then you're aggregating all of the individual's growth to determine an average growth? Or are you taking test scores in a total in third grade and then the next year's third graders' test scores and telling us that that's growth?
Dr. Manson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, your former example with the detail is correct. We are looking at an actual student score in third grade and following that particular student and what growth they have demonstrated in fourth grade, and that's where it is. It is not based on a cohort of third grader groups to fourth grade groups. It's looking at actual students that are moving through the program.
Mr. Chairman, so then can you remind us when we test each at what grade level in each of these subjects? Because I thought we were staggering our testing. Can you just go through?
Every year.
So we're testing every year in reading and in math.
Yes, Ms. Chair, Senator Bonhoeff, that's correct, except at the high school level, and that's why Dr. Melcher was saying in some subjects we don't have both. So in a 10th grade year, so grades 3 through 8, we test reading and mathematics as displayed here, and in high school level we're required to do reading and mathematics. However, in Minnesota, the program is set up to do 10th grade reading and 11th grade mathematics. So obviously 11th graders do not have a reading score, but that number is contributing in there. For 11th graders, that's the only number we have is the group of students who took the math test for that grade.
And so,
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Mattson, so just a couple more questions that I'm glad to hear that answer. I'm relieved. And then with regard to who starts proficient, so it looks like we're taking that into account. You could have an outstanding student, but they may not make much progress. They may slide, and so they wouldn't be counted as significant growth, and yet you could have a student who, you know, is very low, but they make significant progress. In this particular payment, we are looking at growth, not where they come in, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonta, that is correct, yes.
And then, Mr. Chairman, the last thing is, the only then other concern I have is you could have a school district that's very strong at teaching reading, you know, that is off the charts in terms of growth, but very weak in math, and we could still count them as a high if we lump them together. what's your, you know, what do you think about that? Because we're getting an average of the two combined.
Dr. Matz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, you're correct because you're averaging those two together. I guess I would say that the policy implication is that both subjects are important, and so trying to identify that we want growth and excelled performance in each of those subjects is I would say the policy desire there.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Matz, for me, I would view it as a policy that would have the most integrity would actually keeping those two separate and then having a threshold of performance in each rather than combining that. And that's just my own personal view.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if it's possible to do a trial run on how this would play out district by district. I have some concerns that disproportionately the children who are not making proficient are low socioeconomic underserved kids. And so if we have districts that are, you know, not, you know, serve a great deal of underserved kids, while they may make growth, they may not make as much growth. There's data out there that shows that on an average, kids kind of grow about the same, but then during the summer, the kids who are in higher economic districts, they tend to grow because their parents put them in camps and stuff, but the kids who are in low, poor communities, that's where they lose the ground. And so I'm just curious if we could at least see a run of how this would affect the various districts and the various schools.
Mr. Chair.
Deputy Commissioner.
Senator Rummel, we do have a run available on our website. We have done projections for fiscal year 10 and 11. I actually have a copy right here with me. I can just give to you if you'd like it, and we can provide copies to the members as well. But looking at, you know, for instance, Minneapolis, under the plan, they'll receive about $1.85 million in fiscal year 10 under the plan. They have about 41% of students average making medium growth, 27% making high growth. So they would receive 1% times the 41% and then 2% times the 27%. So they have approximately almost 70% of their students that are in the medium to high category. So that's a pretty, I think that's rewarding growth, not rewarding an absolute number that you'll see under No Child Left Behind. So we're trying to reward school districts for making progress. That's why we call it progress and not necessarily just straight performance based on an absolute measure.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to see that.
Yes, if you could share that with us, and then we'll make copies for all of the members. Senator Terezre and then Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rummel just asked the question that I wanted to ask, so I really appreciate it because I want to see those runs. That was what I wanted to request, that we get the runs by district. So thank you.
Okay. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, a number of our school districts tell us that they have really high mobility of students, especially in the lower income areas. So how will you rate students or schools if the, you know, one third of the students are new? Are you going to be able to use the MARS numbers, or how, you know, so they, you don't have the same group necessarily in the same school from one year to the next. So how do you deal with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling.
Deputy Commissioner.
This is based on the growth of the individual students. We're not comparing a cohort of students against a cohort of students. In addition, as under our accountability plan, the school district's responsible for educating that, or responsible under the accountability system for performance if the student was enrolled prior to October 1. So you have situations where students are coming in after October 1. Those students are still tested, but they're not added into the school and district accountability system because that school district or school did not have that child for a complete school year. So we do take an account for that high mobility under our state accountability system and under the pay for progress perform model.
Can a district use the NWEA growth as a testing model?
Mr. Chair, yeah, they certainly can, although this particular provision is using the state's assessment program, because that is the one that we can assure that all districts are included in. But I want to be clear about that, and what I'm saying, that obviously there are many districts that use NWEA. However, this provision is not tied to the use of NWEA.
And how would this narrow the achievement gap? I mean, if you could look at trying to zero in on the achievement gap, would we be spending, you know, in, let's say, a scale of 1 to 10 or 1 to 5, the effectiveness of getting the money to narrow that achievement gap, is this an efficient way of doing it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the governor is attempting to reward school districts that are closing the achievement gap by he wanted to provide additional revenue. He wants to reward school districts that are showing medium to high progress with students, regardless of where those students are at. So really this is trying to reward those districts that are that are closing the achievement gaps with groups of students.
But in large districts, the money really doesn't go to – it goes to the district, not really to the site, right? So, I mean, a district could spend this money however they wanted to if they did get it. I don't know. Maybe it would it seems like it's – I mean, I'm not saying it's not a good program, but it seems like it's a broad brush – at putting money out there, which doesn't have the kind of focus on that just on the achievement gap. Is there any way that you can give us some assurances that the achievement gap in Minnesota would be significantly narrowed if this program was put in place?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you may know, our general education funding formula is very broad and gives a lot of discretion to local school districts as to how to allocate those funds. And under this proposal, the school district will know, you know, basically the students that met the medium and high growth and what percentage at each site met the medium high growth and how that money was generated, so the local school district will be well aware of, you know, what sort of progress they have at each school. In order to make this as simple as possible, we're giving school districts flexibility, as they have under the basic general education formula, to allocate those funds back to their individual sites or into different programs. And we hope that school districts will focus those efforts on improving overall student achievement as well as closing the achievement gap with students. But we're trying to make this as easy as possible for school districts and allow local school boards to allocate those fundings as they do under the basic education formula.
The problem is that the achievement gap isn't being narrowed under the existing program. So I'm just thinking that what would be different about this program if the money doesn't go to those, you know, right into those programs that we have, which would be successful in narrowing that achievement gap? I see the same in the QCOMP program, is that track record isn't that long, but you can apply it across the state, and it probably will have a beneficial effect, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're narrowing that achievement gap. So Senator Rummel and then Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if Mr. Nauman would remind us where this is on the budget.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rummel, you will find this tracked as the pay-for-performance plan. Senator Koch already picked out that the name has changed since the spreadsheet was developed. So there's a $91 million impact.
Which
line 11. Very first page, Senator Rummel.
Okay.
And the tail on this is 102, and that reflects the 80-20 payment schedule that the governor's plan operates under.
Is that the QCOMP money,
Senator
or is
Rummel.
That the...
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, the QCOMP is line 8, and this is line 11.
So
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's $50 million, $50.6 million for the 11 and $40.6 million. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct.
And
Senator
Rummel. Does this then come in, this is in place of the formula or the base, or is it on top of the base?
It's on top. Or Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, the governor's recommending this would be additional dollars, and there is no change to the basic formula allowance under the governor's recommendation.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that, you know, one of our major goals is to close the achievement gap, but one of my major frustrations is that I think that's what the compensatory money is supposed to be for, or the integration aid. And there has been no proof that that money has helped do that at all. And I just get so frustrated. We can't just keep putting more money at something that isn't working. They already have a lot of additional money in the schools where they have high levels of children in poverty, and we're still not seeing the gains that we'd like to see. So I think we need more than money. We need some kind of really rigorous plan that those districts can show us that they're going to perform. But we need accounting, too. And at least this is one form of accountability, that a measurement of how they're doing from year to year with individual children. I guess I like the report card idea. And I just don't know, you know, how we can get to the bottom of it. It's the compensatory aid has been there for a long time, and there is a big difference in the aid that schools in Minneapolis get compared to, like, my districts where I am, and the achievement levels are just huge. Even though the districts I represent get a lot less money than the other districts, sometimes almost half. I mean, it's just huge. And so we have to think of something that's going to make a difference here. The biggest frustration I have is, as Commissioner Anderson said before, it seems to be that the biggest factor is the families, but we never know how to address that. If that's half of the reason how a child performs is the family support they get, and we never really address that because it's a very difficult thing for government to do. But is there something we could do? How do we get to that part of the equation that is half of the reason a student performs well or not? And I just, you know, they often say the biggest indicator of a child's school readiness is their mother's educational level. And that, you know, so do we work on the upper end first? Do we just try and get as many people through high school and some post-secondary so that in the future we have children that are better prepared? I mean, but we can't lose a generation. So I just don't know. But we have to keep working on graduation rates and post-secondary education, too, because then we will in the future have children that are better prepared and do better in school when their parents are better prepared. But it's a huge frustration, and I don't know where the money and the resources should be put, but it hasn't been working where it is being put right now.
Well, you bring up a lot of good points, and the one that I would refer back to is when I think it was Senator Scheid, when we had Senator Scheid's bill before us, Brooklyn Center is a small district, but one that has a lot of complex issues, high poverty, high diversity, you name it. That district is a typical district that should be struggling immensely. But I think what they've done out there has been to take and they have had high quality teachers that have really been they've had to go out and actually seek out money in different ways to keep their programs going. They've I think academically turned it around, and I would like to see information as to what the achievement gap would be in Brooklyn Center. The superintendent talked about community type schools where they had multiple collaborative efforts on the part of not only just the school district, but many, many different services that were working together like crazy to assist and raise satisfy the different needs that students had, and the outcome I think was good, and actually I think we were spending less money in that district than many districts that had less need, and so I think there are ways to do it. I don't know if you know, I do think that the strength of this program would be that it's based on some, you know, some more concrete data. But if you look at the QCOMP program, we're talking about another, you know, $40 to $50 million per year. I am a firm believer in high-quality teachers, but it's not... It's not attached to the achievement gap or trying to close that achievement gap. So I don't know. I think Senator Saltzman.
Yes. A comment and then a question, Mr. Chair. You know, on this particular proposal, one of the things that I think I heard this committee reflect on last week as we heard about the stimulus money was there's money for a year, and then it goes away. And so when we hear from school districts about how to fund schools, we continue to hear about stability, you know, knowing what's going to be there from year to year. So I guess with this program, I am a little concerned that, you know, will the money be there to continue a program, to continue something that a school district might, you know, put in place? So that's just a comment. But then a question on this as how we calculate growth. Where are special education students in this? And perhaps you did touch on that, because I know in one of my school districts recently that a charter school has talked about how high performing they are, that they're doing a far better job than our public school as our district schools. And when the district took out all of the students with special needs and started looking at aggregate test scores, there was an aha moment of, wait a minute, not necessarily. So in this, because I think we do see, you know, in some school districts there are higher concentrations of special ed students who may have difficulty in terms of growth, how is this reflected in there? Again, because one school district, and as Nirvana pointed out, you know, it's higher once you reach a high bar to keep up. You know, it's like a time for a cross country meet. You know, it's a lot easier to drop your time until you get to under 17 minutes for a 5K. So, tell me how those might be addressed here, please.
Before that, you answer that question. Members, we are going to hopefully get through Article 1, and then we will, that'll be our cutoff for today. And then tomorrow we'll start in on Article 2 and finish the discussion, plus take testimony tomorrow on the proposal. So, okay. On Senator Saltzman's question, Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, any student that takes the MCA right now would be included in this. So that does include a majority of the students who are with disabilities or students with IEPs. The only students that would not include right now under our program would be those students with the most significant cognitive disabilities, which take the test called the Minnesota Test of Academic Skills. That is approximately 1 to 1.8% of the student population in the state. So all the rest of those students are currently in this formula.
Okay. Either Dr. Mattson or Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, that would if there's no more questions, okay. That would conclude Article 1.
Are there any other questions that members have? I know this is quite a bit to bite off, but we'll certainly think about it. As we look at phasing out the MCA2s, does that have any implication on Dr. Mattson, you mentioned that the MCA2s, this is kind of based on that testing model. But as we look at other types of testing models, what we'd have to do is basically keep in mind that we need to have a growth model model that can be used for growth as we, if this becomes part of our package.
Mr. Chair, it's a very good question, and you're absolutely right. Regardless of the pay issue, the dollar amounts aligned to this, we know that we have technical responsibilities to try. We can't restart every 5 years on growth and progress. And I will say, and credit to the architects of this this design, is that it actually can be applied in a change to another assessment system, if you will, if you move to another one. So if we move to the MCA3s, because it's based on actuarial data, it's real data, we don't have to have necessarily all of the matching scale scores and all the rest of this, that this approach can be applied in a nice transition to a transition to a different testing program, et cetera.
Mr. Chair,
Deputy Commissioner,
I just want to mention that the page did hand out a document with the title Growth Model, and it includes district-by-district runs for members, so they have that information before they leave here today. Thank you to the page for doing that work.
All right. Yes, thank you. And then, members, if you could kind of gather up the papers that you have in front of you and either set them on top of your folder or put them inside, because we'll be coming back. It would be helpful to put them inside your folder. Then tomorrow when we come back, we'll be able to have those available. So thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner Dr. Melcher, Dr. Mattson. And tomorrow we'll continue on. Committee is adjourned. Yeah, a lot of questions.
Okay, so you would have to say.
Here's my thought. If you can identify, you can quantify it.